First of all, let's keep things in perspective. The Ukrainian army has been on the Russian border for some time now. So to talk about the Ukrainian army, you know, going up to the Russian border in the Kharkov Oblast, yeah, it's a reversal. There's no way to spin this other than to say that Ukraine won a battle, a very important battle, a politically important battle. But it's a Pyrrhic victory for Ukraine. You know, this was predicted. Back in May, I did an interview with an American media personnel named Garland Nixon. And at that time, I said the provision by the United States of $53 billion worth of military assistance, military and economic assistance, coupled with the tens of billions of dollars of similar assistance provided by NATO and European countries, coupled with intelligence that's being provided, coupled with logistics, coupled with training facilities in Europe out of the range of Russian reprisals that were training tens of thousands of Ukrainians on this new equipment. This was a game changer that it will fundamentally alter the reality of the battlefield. And what happened in September, in the early September, was a clear manifestation of this. You know, prior to this, one could safely say that the Ukrainian army was a military. It was a Ukrainian army that was, you know, funded and trained and equipped by NATO and the United States, but still a Ukrainian army. The military that went into action on September 1st was a NATO army manned by Ukrainians, and there's a qualitative difference, and that qualitative difference is a direct result of the, you know, nearly $100 billion worth of assistance that Ukraine has received from all fronts. And they took advantage of a situational failure on the part of Russia, not a systemic failure, a situational failure, combination of a operational pause after nearly 5 months of offensive operations. Russian units were resting, re-equipping, refitting. All militaries do this. You won't find a military in the world that can sustain a five-month-long offensive and just keep going. They have to pause. So the Russians hit the pause button. The Russians were also taking advantage of this pause to form their own offensive forces, and so they were stripping units away from the Kharkov region back to Russia for this purpose. And they replaced these units with units were insufficient to the task, both in terms of their organization and their doctrine. You know, the Russian division is supposed to defend a frontage of 20 kilometers wide and up to 15 into 20 kilometers deep. And that's important, defense in depth, because Russian doctrine is designed to absorb the very kind of attack that this new NATO army manned by Ukrainians carried out to dissipate the attack, to channel it into kill zones. Then once the attack is spent, to hit it with counterattacking forces that pinch it off, surround it, and annihilate it. That's what Russian defense does. But that only works if you have Russian military units trained in this this kind of defensive operation deployed to the battlefield. These had been withdrawn to be re-equipped. They were replaced by police units, the equivalent of SWAT teams, militia units, National Guard units that were not trained, organized, equipped to fight massive frontal assaults by armor and mechanized infantry, which is what the Ukrainians
In which case, Zelensky's intelligence is good. It was a masterstroke.
Well, first of all, it's not Zelensky's intelligence. It's NATO's intelligence. And it was a masterstroke. It was brilliant. It was well executed. But let's take a look at what happened. Russia, the Russian units in the front line held. The Ukrainians didn't surround and destroy any Russian units. They surrounded several Russian units that held and were holding up the attack. The Russian counterattack that was designed to blunt the Ukrainian advance was instead diverted to relieve these surrounded troops and help them withdraw in good order, preserving nearly the totality of their manpower. The most precious resource a military has is its manpower. Russia hardly lost any troops. You can count their casualties in the hundreds. Ukraine, on the other hand, took 30,000 well-trained troops and proceeded to lose more than a third of them. And they're losing them even more today in large numbers as they try to press their offensive advantage to no avail. Russia carried out a very difficult withdrawal of forces, going back to a new defensive line. They established this defensive line under pressure. The defensive line has held and is currently repulsing Ukrainian attacks. So at the end of the day, the Ukrainians got a lot of territory that had limited strategic value for Russia. It's a huge propaganda win for the Ukrainians. Lots of selfies being taken of Ukrainians raising flags on villages and towns formerly occupied by the Russians. It's a feel-good moment. But when it's all said and done, I mean, let's imagine that that we woke up not knowing anything about the counteroffensive. And I said, hey, Tony, headlines today. Ukraine loses 12,000 troops. Russia loses 200 troops. Who won that battle? And you'll say Russia. Okay, so now we suddenly pollute our minds by looking at a map where Ukraine punched into a vacuum, occupied a lot of territory, but they spent their force. They don't have any reserves left. They used them all. Russia, on the other hand, yeah, it's a defeat. Russia got beat. I mean, it's an intelligence failure. It's a failure of imagination, but it's not a strategic failure. They preserve their manpower. They will be able to reform these units, re-equip these units, and re-employ these units. There's 12,000 Ukrainians that aren't going to be used again, along with thousands of pieces of equipment.
Yeah, you've probably seen that the Russians have accused the Germans of supplying much of the equipment here. And they've actually said, I'm not quite sure who it is and where in the Russian establishment has said it, but they've said that the Germans have crossed a red line in supplying far too much of the equipment that was used in this counteroffensive.
Well, I mean, with all due respect to the Russians, boo-hoo. Grow up. What do you mean Germany provide too much equipment? You're at war with Ukraine. Ukraine's going to get the assistance it needs from Europe. And if Europe's willing to provide it, Ukraine's willing to receive it and use it. I mean, that's spilled milk. I'd like to go back to the source of that and verify, because that sounds too much like spilled milk. The Russians have always said that, while they think that it's wrong for Europe to prolong this conflict by providing heavy weapons, as long as the heavy weapons aren't of a nature that can enable Ukraine to strike deep into Russia, the Russian solution will be to kill them, which is what they've been doing.
It may be, Scott, that a more serious criticism is they believe that there's been a massive use of mercenaries in this attack.
Well, that's real. That's very real. You know, when this conflict started, Ukraine went out and put a call out for international volunteers to form something called the International Legion. And this was an abysmal failure. People that showed up were fat couch potatoes, wannabe warriors, airsoft posers, whatever you want to say, but they weren't real. And they performed abysmally at the front line. And the Ukrainians found that having them present did more harm than good. I can't say that about the International Legion that went into battle, in this current offensive. These were extraordinarily professional forces, extremely well-trained, tactically proficient. They were brilliant in their ability to carry out deep raids behind the Russian lines to disrupt Russian logistics, command and control, etc. And you have to ask yourself, how did they make this transition? And I think the answer is that this is a different legion. These aren't so much as volunteers as these are professional warriors who exist in a database that's been assembled by the CIA and the American Department of Defense over the past 20 years through the conduct of what's called foreign internal defense, which is an American special operation where Americans train the armed forces of nations designated to receive this training. And in doing so, we are able to evaluate people, assess their potential for for utilization in you know, covert actions. And I think what's happened here is that the United States, together with Germany, France, Great Britain, have tapped into this database and have done a massive recruitment of highly qualified professional warriors who they brought together using a contract employment structure. And they're very effective. They're very effective. They're very good. It's very different than what had been done before. These guys are good at reconnaissance. They're good at specialized operation, direct action, deep strike, et cetera. They're not going to change the outcome on the battlefield. The Russians already have the solution. I mean, you can only fool the Russians once. And one of the first things that happened when these units were employed is that Russia began to field, International Legion special operations teams. That is their own convoy of light vehicles that were roaming the rear area, seeking out these International Legionnaires and to, you know, close with and destroy them. So I think they had their moment. They all got to make their TikTok video. They can, you know, impress their girlfriend for the next 15 to 30 days that they'll be alive. But their time is up. Ukraine, the Russians are going to single them out and are singling them out, and they will die a violent death.
Finally, I know you're pushed for time, Scott, but we also seen the breaking out of this parallel conflict, in a way parallel, between Armenia and Azerbaijan. What do you make of that at the moment?
Well, the Armenian-Azerbaijan conflict, it dates back a long time, depending on how far we're going to go, but its recent roots are from 1988, when Nagorno-Karabakh, which is primarily an area, a mountainous area, primarily populated by Armenians, but it's located in the midst of Azerbaijani territory. They declared their independence and their desire to unite with Armenia. This led to the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, which I think came to a head in 1993, when the Armenian army was able to occupy about 15-20% of Azerbaijan, linking Nagorno-Karabakh with Armenia proper and inflicting a decisive defeat on the Azerbaijanis. They were unable to get a peace agreement, and Azerbaijan, together with Turkey, was able to build up its military capacity and I think last year launched a major offensive that recaptured virtually all of the territory they had originally lost and inflicted a strategic defeat on the Armenian army, forcing the Armenian government to sue for peace. Since then, they've been struggling to find a ceasefire. And the reason why I bring all of this history up is this isn't a second front that was just imagined by, you know, the United States and others on how to get Russia. No, this is a unstable area of the world that has the roots of the conflict of which predate the Ukrainian conflict by years. This isn't something that just happened. This is something that has been brewing all along. It came to a head. And I think the Russians are very mature in their approach to this. They've avoided unnecessary escalation. They've refused to allow the STO treaty framework to be engaged directly. They're playing their relations with Turkey to tone down the Azerbaijanis. They're actually encouraging the European Union to be involved, the United Nations to be involved. So if anybody thought that this was going to be a second front that was going to drain Russian resources away from Ukraine, they're sadly mistaken.
Well, yes, you're putting a good case there. But what with this defeat in the Kharkov region and war breaking out in the Caucasus, Putin's got his big speech at the Eastern equivalent of the World Economic Forum over in Vladivostok last week with egg on his face, hasn't he?
No, he's so much more mature than that. He's looking at the big picture. The big picture is he's praising the economic ties with China, praising the economic ties with India, praising the developments that Russia's made to pivot away from the West and open up relations with the East. He's sitting in the catbird seat. No objective analyst of the bigger picture here, which recognizes that the ground war in Ukraine is but one theater of operation in a larger geopolitical struggle that hinges on economic developments, the end of the hegemony of the American dollar, the growth of a currency basket involving Russia, China, India, and others, where the ruble, a stable ruble, it plays critical importance. Putin has stabilized the ruble. The ruble is strengthening. The Russian economy is stable. It's strengthening. That's what Putin's focused on, because ultimately that's what's going to win this conflict. Let's wait and see what happens this winter. You know, right now, Zelensky is feeling good with a couple selfies in Izium. The Europeans are feeling good because they've provided billions of dollars worth of equipment that had an impact on the battlefield. But General Mudd is going to inject himself very soon, bogging everything down. And General Winter is going to come. And I think Russia is going to be pretty warm, well-fed, and comfortable. I can't say the same for Europe.
Okay, Scott, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.